You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the November 2018 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of The Y Squad by Adam Schirowski. The inside story of Yamam's genesis has not been told by its leaders until now. In 1972, during the Summer Olympics in Munich, members of the Palestinian group Black September kidnapped and murdered 11 Israeli teammates. The cold-blooded attack and Germany's botched response prompted Israel's Prime Minister Golda Meir to initiate Operation Wrath of God, sending hit squads to track down and kill the group's organizers and others, later depicted in Steven Spielberg's Munich. And though it may have escaped public attention, a secret second directive would go forth as well, which ordered the establishment of a permanent strike force to deter or defeat future attacks. This mandate would not be realized until 2 years later, after terrorists sneaked across the border from Lebanon, killed a family of three, and took over an elementary school in Maalot with 105 students and 10 teachers inside, hoping to negotiate for the release of their brethren held in Israeli prisons. Sayeret Matkal raced to the scene and mounted a disastrous rescue attempt. 21 students perished. Addressing the Knesset, Meir exclaimed, "The blood of our children, the martyrs of Maalot, cries out to us, exhorting us to intensify our war against terrorism, to perfect our methods." Following the attack, counterterrorism responsibilities, especially the delicate art of hostage rescue, shifted from the IDF to a new police unit, initially dubbed the Fist Brigade, and later Yamam. Chronically underfunded, ostracized by the military, and deemed an unknown quantity by the intelligence services, the unit was a backwater. That is, until Asaf Hafetz was put in charge. He was a well-regarded IDF paratrooper with important friends, among them future Prime Minister Ehud Barak. Hafetz had supported the April 1973 operation in which Barak, famously disguised as a woman, infiltrated Beirut and killed several Palestinian Liberation Organization leaders as part of Israel's ongoing retaliation for Munich. Hafetz professionalized Yamam, persuading skilled soldiers to join his new police commando unit, whose work was a secret to all but a handful of Israelis. Next photo. Location, Israeli-Egyptian border. Date, August 2011. Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak, gesturing in this photo, visits the scene of a deadly jihadist incursion. In May, I visited Hafetz, aged 74, in the seaside hamlet of Caesarea and found a man with the body of a 24-year-old and the hearing of a 104-year-old. Like many of his generation of Israelis, he speaks his mind without regard for how his words may land. After 18 months, I had recruited and trained three platoons, and I knew that my unit was much better than the army, he insisted, but I was the only person in the country who thought so. In due course, he found an eager partner in the spy masters of Shin Bet, who agreed to let Yamam try its hand the treacherous work of neutralizing suspected terrorists. Still, it was Hafetz personally who first put Yamam on the map. On the morning of March 11th, 1978, armed guerrillas arrived on Zodiac boats from Lebanon, coming ashore near Haifa. Once inland, they encountered and murdered an American named Gail Rubin, whose close relative happened to be Abraham Ribicoff, a powerful U.S. senator. Next, they flagged down a taxi, murdered its occupants, then hijacked a bus. Traveling south along the picturesque coastal highway, they threw hand grenades at passing cars and shot some of the bus passengers. The attack was timed in hopes of disrupting peace talks between Israel's Prime Minister Menachem Begin and Egyptian President Anwar Sadat. The rolling pandemonium came to a halt at a junction north of Tel Aviv. When I arrived, my unit was still an hour away, Hafetz recalled. The bus had stopped, but it was a charred wreck. No one knows exactly what happened. Call it the fog of war. Hafetz soon learned that some of the assailants had escaped on foot and were moving toward the beach. He grabbed his gun and gave chase, eventually killing two of them, capturing a third, and rescuing some of the hostages. In the process, he took a bullet to his right shoulder and lost hearing in one ear. The incident, known as the Coastal Road Massacre, claimed the lives of more than 36 people. But Hafetz's valor raised the question, given what Yamam's commander accomplished on his own, what could the unit as a whole do if properly harnessed? The answer was a decade in coming, during which time Yamam was bigfooted by Sayeret Matkal during its response to terrorist attacks. In the notorious Bus 300 affair, for example, Sayeret Matkal commandos stormed a bus to rescue hostages and claimed it had killed 4 terrorists, when in fact 2 had survived. The pair were turned over to Shin Bet operatives, who, a short distance away, murdered them in cold blood. The debacle and its aftermath, which disgraced Shin Bet chief Avraham Shalom, who had ordered the on-site assassinations and then tried to cover it up, left an indelible stain on Israel's institutions and international credibility. In 1987, Alik Ron, a man with deep credentials and a devil-may-care attitude, took over Yamam. He had served in Sayeret Matkal and participated in the legendary 1976 raid on Entebbe, in which an IDF team stormed a Ugandan airport and successfully freed more than 100 hostages. I was in our most elite units and took part in the most celebrated mission in our history, said Ron, who in retirement has become a gentleman farmer. Only when I was put in charge of Yamam did I realize I was in the company of the most professional unit in Israel. And yet, when he first addressed his men to say how proud he was to lead them, describing all the great things they would accomplish together, they broke out laughing. Apparently, the operatives were fed up with being highly trained bench warmers, always left on the sidelines. Ron persevered nevertheless, and he is withering in his assessment of his old unit, Sayeret Matkal, and its overseers. Nobody, not the head of Shin Bet, not Mossad, not the Prime Minister, can give me an order to kill terrorists after they have been captured. He can get me an order, but I will do like this, he said, lifting his middle finger. I will not murder them. I will have already killed them in the bus. Ron soon got the chance to try things his way. In 1988, he learned that 3 terrorists had crossed in from Egypt and hijacked a bus full of working mothers on their way to Dimona, the epicenter of Israel's top-secret nuclear weapons program. As Ron raced toward the Negev Desert to link up with his team, he saw CH-53 Sea Stallions on the horizon, heading in the same direction. pounding his fist on his dashboard and unleashing a stream of expletives, Ron recalled. He screamed, "Sirat Matkal, again?" Ehud Barak was on one of those helicopters. A man who would go on to hold virtually every position in Israeli officialdom, prime minister, defense minister, commander of the armed forces, and head of Sayeret Matkal. Recalling his first encounter with Yamam 30 years ago, Barak, now 76, expressed astonishment at how Ron and his team had somehow managed to arrive ahead of Sayeret Matkal's helicopters, raring to go. "We asked them what they brought with them," Barak recalled. "It ended up they brought everything which was needed for taking over the bus. So we let them do it." According to David Tsur, who was a major at the time and would later take over as Yamam's commander, the so-called Mother's Bus incident was a turning point because it showcased the unit's speed, judgment, and agility. "We were called to the field at 7:30 in the morning," he said. "Before we arrived, the attackers had killed 3 hostages. At around 10:30, the team's snipers shot 2 of the attackers, while other Yamam members stormed the bus and shot the remaining assailant. No hostages were killed during the operation," Tsur proudly recalled. Israel's national security apparatus, including skeptical IDF generals, took notice and recognized that when it came to counterterrorism, they had a scalpel at their disposal instead of blunter instruments. "I don't believe that anyone has a better unit," Barak observed. "They are kind of irreplaceable. The road to Sinai. Lately, Yamam has gotten used to terror's new face. Extremist intent on inflicting maximum carnage with maximum visibility. I've been in dozens of operations and many times under fire, facing many terrorist and suicide bombers," In admitted. "But the one I remember more than all the others is the terror attack on the border in the Sinai Desert. It was August 2011, 6 months after the Arab Spring ouster of Egypt's Hosni Mubarak, and 3 years before ISIS formally declared its caliphate. Yamam, tipped off by Shin Bet that a large-scale attack was imminent somewhere along Israel's southern border, dispatched 1 squadron and a sniper team by helicopter. They waited through the night before getting word that shots had been fired at a bus, injuring passengers inside. A family of 4 traveling the same highway was ambushed and slaughtered. This group of ISIS Salafi jihadists that came from the Sinai Desert, they were a different challenge for us," N said of the 12-man death squad. "We know from intelligence that they received training abroad. They were proficient with weapons, grenades, explosive charges, and even had handcuffs to kidnap people. They also brought cameras to film their handiwork." In, who was a squadron commander at the time, was fired at twice as his Yamam team arrived on the scene. In the skirmish, 1 militant detonated a suicide vest, killing himself and a bus driver. And In recalled, "A terrorist shot a surface-to-air missile at one of our helicopters, but it missed. 2 gunmen were spotted crossing the highway. 1 was killed in an exchange of fire, while a 2nd took aim at a passenger vehicle, killing the driver." By mid-afternoon, the scene seemed to be under control, and Pascal Avrahami, a legendary Yamam sniper, briefed his superiors, including then-Defense Minister Barak. A short time later, shots rang out from the Egyptian side of the border. 4 Yamam operators scrambled for cover. and in the frenzy, a 7.62-millimeter round hit Avrahami above the ceramic body armor covering his chest. The sniper, a 49-year-old father of three, had been killed by an enemy sniper who simply melted back into the desert. I joined in this past April at Mount Herzl, the final resting place of many of the nation's fallen warriors. It was Israel's Remembrance Day, a somber holiday when life and commerce grind to a halt. On this day, Anne spent time with Avrahami's parents at their son Pascal's grave, embracing them and reminiscing about his outsized role in the unit. The previous evening, as the sun descended, squad members had stood in the courtyard of the Yamam compound, having refreshments and trading stories. Family members of slain commandos were taken inside a darkened shooting range, where their loved ones' holographic images were projected in midair. The scene was otherworldly, but somehow appropriate for this secretive, high-tech cadre. On this Remembrance Day, N mourned the loss of his friend, whose 24 years of service made him Yamam's longest-serving member. But he stopped at one point to stress that his team is focused less on the past than on the future. We know the enemy will always try and do something worse, something bigger, something extraordinary that they never did before. And for this scenario, we are preparing ourselves. skin in the game. 40 years ago, the NFL turned cheerleaders into sex objects. Now, they're fighting back. By Michelle Ruiz. Opening photo, fantasy football. The Dallas Cowboys led the way in selling sex on the sidelines, while paying cheerleaders next to nothing. It was a business, observed three veterans of the squad, and we were the merchandise. They call each other girls, even though they are grown women now, some of them grandmothers in their 60s. Few look it. Most are lithe and fit from a lifetime of exercise. Early this morning, they convened for a variety of fitness classes, including a twerk-out workout, a hot heels dance class, and cheer Zumba, followed by a panel on the good, bad, and ugly of cosmetics procedures. Now they are buzzing around a banquet hall, set up in a club seating deck on the upper level of Nissan Stadium in Nashville, home of the Tennessee Titans. There are nearly 500 former NFL cheerleaders, Washington Redskinettes, Seattle Seagulls, Chicago Honey Bears, Buffalo Jills, and the Queen Supremes, the Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders. When they walk in, you can just tell, says one alumna. They have gathered for the biennial National Football Cheerleaders Alumni Reunion, and the room is crackling with the bubbly brand of energy that many of the girls call sparkle, which also serves as an implicit dress code. There are sparkles on dresses, sparkles on earrings, sparkles on stilettos. It's awesome to get reunited with my cheer sisters, as we like to say, gushes Jennifer Hathaway, a former Atlanta Falconette whose eyes are dusted with sparkly shadow. The ex-cheerleaders have been drawn here by their shared past, a collective nostalgia for their days on the sidelines, their moment in the spotlight. But despite their giddiness at being reunited, they know there is no escaping the present. Over the past year, the NFL has faced a rash of lawsuits and ugly allegations over its treatment of cheerleaders. 5 former members of the Washington Redskins squad say the team flew them to Costa Rica in 2013, stripped them of their passports, and required them to pose topless before wealthy fans. In March, former cheerleader Bailey Davis sued the New Orleans Saints for firing her over an Instagram photo she posted of herself in a lacy bodysuit. And in June, 6 former cheerleaders filed a federal sex discrimination suit against the Houston Texans, alleging they were paid less than the state's minimum wage and relentlessly body-shamed by the squad coach, who called them jelly bellies and crack whores. I had no idea that once I became a Houston Texan cheerleader, all of my dreams would slowly be shattered, one of the plaintiffs, Morgan Wiederhold, said at a news conference. The teams have all denied the allegations, and the NFL insists that it supports fair employment practices. The cheerleader alumni assembled at the reunion, meanwhile, aren't eager to discuss the league's hashtag MeToo moment. Since we're being real and honest with each other, the last couple of years, there have been some controversies in the NFL. The evening's co-host, Lisa Guerrero, chief investigative correspondent for Inside Edition and a one-time Rams cheerleader, acknowledges when she takes the stage. I know that some of these controversies have been painful, and some of them have been difficult for us to deal with as a unit. But what I like to say to people is that had it not been for the background I had in the NFL, there's no way that I could have been on television or have the sisterhood that we all have. We're here to celebrate. Some women at the reunion say privately that they experienced similar mistreatment during their time in the NFL. But rather than sympathize with their modern-day cheer sisters, they seem intent on siding with their old teams. None of this conversation about the pay and the discrimination and the treatment, none of that is new to me, says Kathy Core, founder of the now-defunct Chicago Honey Bears. My feeling is that when you come into a group, you sign a contract. You know what you're getting into. Nothing that you're going to cry about is going to make it any different. None of that is new. Such dismissals contain a tacit admission of a deeper reality. The low pay, the body shaming, the draconian rules about appearance and behavior that apply to cheerleaders but not players. These are not the work of a few rogue coaches or lecherous owners. The NFL's current crisis, in fact, is the result of a series of carefully crafted marketing plans put into place by teams across the league in the 1970s to sell sex on the sidelines. One by one, front offices from Buffalo to San Diego gave NFL cheerleading an extreme makeover designed to tap into the fantasies of male fans. The move took place at the very moment that pro football was transforming itself into the world's most lucrative sports entertainment behemoth. Altogether, the NFL's 32 franchises are worth an estimated $80 billion. According to Forbes, to woo TV viewers, court sponsors, and boost their brands, teams systematically set out to turn their cheerleaders into sex objects, ones who would serve as cheap labor in the hope that the opportunity would rocket them to stardom in Hollywood or the media. Next, photos. Extreme makeover. Cheerleaders started out as men before the NFL turned them into what a former Dallas cheerleader calls sideline accessories. Yale's male yell leaders circa 1925. Baltimore Colts cheerleaders, the league's first full-time squad in 1960. Dallas cheerleaders in 1967, before their transformation. And Buffalo Jills in 1993, not long before they became the first and only squad to unionize. They own you, says Debbie Kepley, a personal trainer in Los Angeles, who performed as a Dallas Cowboys cheerleader during the boom years of 1976 to 1978. Even though they wanted you to be a representative of the Cowboys, you were still just an accessory, a sideline accessory. It's like being a Miss America. You will do anything they say to be a part of all of the glitz, the glamour, the cameras, the excitement, and hope. That's where they take advantage of people. Three sisters who joined the Cowboys squad after Kepley, Stephanie, Suzette, and Sherry Schultz, put it even more succinctly in their 1991 tell-all memoir, Deep in the Heart of Texas, Reflections of Former Dallas Cowboys Cheerleaders. It was a business, the sisters observe, and we were the merchandise. In the beginning, cheerleaders were neither modest women nor sexy women. In fact, they weren't women at all. As college football took off in the early 1900s, enthusiastic male students in the then all-male Ivy League organically spilled out of the stands and onto the sidelines, becoming the first yell leaders and rooter kings. Perhaps not coincidentally, when cheerleading was a predominantly male activity, it carried considerably more weight. The reputation of having been a valiant cheerleader is one of the most valuable things a boy can take away from college, the Nation wrote in 1911. Though male cheerleaders endured at some upper-crust schools, think George W. Bush at Yale, there was a Rosie the Riveting of the sport during the Second World War. As men shipped off overseas, women stepped into their saddle shoes. Cheerleading hit the big leagues in 1954, when the Baltimore Colts cheerleaders became the first full-time squad in the NFL. Their look was more Jackie than Marilyn: letter sweaters, bobby socks, and homemade pom-poms. They got dressed in the stadium's boiler room, recalls one Colts alumna at the reunion, all huddled around a single mirror. In what would become an NFL tradition, the founding Colts cheerleaders were paid exactly nothing. Other teams soon followed suit, debuting cheerleaders of their own, including the Dallas Cowbells and Bows, a group of co-ed high school students who tumbled and made human pyramids. Next photo, pinup prophets. The Dallas squad in 1978. We became million-dollar showgirls who made $15 a game, said one. Cheerleading retained its girl-next-door innocence until one fateful day in November 1967, when a Dallas burlesque performer named Bubbles Cash sauntered through the stands at a Cowboys game wearing a micro miniskirt and carrying cotton candy. Photos from the game show the men around Cash going nuts. Local newspapers crowned her the belle of the football. Cash, a canny crowd pleaser, blew kisses to her admirers. The unexpected sensation did not go unnoticed. Tex Schramm, the Cowboys' general manager, shared Cash's flair for marketing. Schramm was known as the P.T. Barnum of the NFL, says Dana Adam Shapiro, director of Daughters of the Sexual Revolution, the untold story of the Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders. He was the one who had the initial vision for showgirls on the sidelines of sporting events. He realized there's a lot of downtime in football. It couldn't just be guys on the field running into each other. You had to turn it into showbiz. And the cheerleaders were one of the ways that he turned it into the greatest show on earth. A former executive of CBS Sports, Schramm had already tailored the game to the TV era, helping to pioneer instant replay and create the Super Bowl, America's most valuable sports brand. Now, inspired by Cash, Schramm reinvented the cheerleaders as sexy, glamorous, scantily clad showgirls, dressing them in the now legendary royal blue halter tops, star-spangled vest, hot pants, and white go-go boots. We had to tie the knot a certain way to give us the most cleavage, recalls Kepley, who made the team in 1976. Very few people had fake boobs back then. They were just starting to hit the market. Raised a scrappy latchkey kid by a single mom, Kepley was working as a clerk at federal bankruptcy court when she heard an ad on the radio for Dallas cheerleader tryouts. Women were asked to come dressed in short shorts and halters and to free dance to disco music while the judges subjected their bodies to unabashed assessments. We were supposed to be wholesome but sexy, Kepley says, like a Barbie doll. The new cheerleaders, in fact, were deliberately cast to fit a wide range of male fantasies. Each girl's look was a part of the big scheme, the Schultz sisters wrote in their memoir. There was the long-haired blonde, the girl with the ponytail, the pigtail girl, the tall brunette, the perky little brunette, the bouncy blonde, the sultry redhead. Guys in the stadium would fixate on their preferred type. Men would be yelling down, "Shake it, Stephanie, shake it," recalls Stephanie Schultz, who started out as a pageant queen in Lubbock before moving up to the Cowboys squad. The new image was engineered especially for TV. Andy Sedaris, the director of ABC's Monday Night Football, patented the honey shot, the practice of cutting away from the game between plays and beaming appreciative shots of the Dallas cheerleaders to millions of viewers across the country. "I got the idea for honey shots because I'm a dirty old man," Sedaris admitted from his control room in the 1976 documentary Seconds to Play. You gotta show some girls, and occasionally we'll get a football play in there. The NFL, meanwhile, looked on without objection. Schramm had personally given Pete Rozelle, the league's commissioner, his first job in football on the PR staff of the Los Angeles Rams. Rozelle courted and massaged the television and Madison Avenue leaders, Richard Crepeau, author of NFL Football, A History of America's New National Pastime, has observed, like Schramm, Rozelle knew that sex sells. With the league's blessing, the Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders, known reverentially as the DCC, exploded into an all-out pop culture sensation. They were featured on playing cards, inspired a TV movie starring Jane Seymour, made cameo appearances on The Love Boat and Family Feud, and circled the globe on USO tours at the express request of the Defense Department. And thanks to another of Schramm's marketing schemes, they appeared on a splashy, unequivocally sexy poster meant to rival Farrah Fawcett's famed 1976 pinup. The Cowboys tapped Bob Shaw, a Dallas-based freelance photographer, to stage and shoot the poster. Shaw says it was clear what Schramm was thinking. We can get 1 million impressions out there. Maybe we can make a dollar. For ambiance, Shaw fired up a smoke machine and rigged his studio with neon lights inspired by the lightsabers in Star Wars. He positioned 5 of the squad's cheerleaders in a V formation, with their feathery faucet hair and barely there uniforms, making bedroom eyes into his lens. God, we got a gold mine here, Shaw recalls thinking. It was electrical. The poster was printed by Pro Arts, the same company that distributed faucets, and was sold nationwide among the whoopee cushions and fake poop at Spencer Gifts, wallpapering the bedrooms of teenage boys across America. Shaw received $14,000 for the shoot, and the Cowboys made at least $1.8 million from the poster. But when I asked Shaw if the cheerleaders shared in the revenue, he burst out laughing. Oh, no, he says. I paid them more than anybody with nice catering. They didn't get anything. At their peak, the DCC as a unit were, by some calculations, nearly as famous as Fawcett herself. But while they were brand ambassadors and game day draws and razzle-dazzle performers featured on nationwide TV, they were paid around $100 per season before taxes, barely enough to cover gas to the stadium and dry cleaning for their iconic uniforms. As one former cheerleader told filmmaker Dana Adam Shapiro, we became million-dollar showgirls who made $15 a game. The Dallas model of sexing up the cheerleaders sparked what Sports Illustrated called the Great Cheerleading War of 1978, as rival teams raced to match the Cowboys in displaying belly buttons, bust, and backsides. The Bengals dressed their squad in sarongs decorated with hand-painted tigers. The Chargers replaced their old uniforms of white leotards, pleated skirts, and tennis shoes with white briefs, blue satin halters, top hats, and gold lamé boots. Everyone is trying to out-Dallas Dallas, an assistant Falcons manager said at the time. In Chicago, Bears owner George Papa Bear Halas declared that he wanted to have his own set of dancing girls on the field to distract fans from a losing season. The team tapped Kathy Core, who had left a convent to coach cheerleaders for a church middle school, as founder of the Honey Bears. Halas, Core says, knew right from the beginning that he had to give the people something more for their dollar. According to Core, the team intentionally dressed the Honey Bears in a white one-piece leotard with a lace-up front to accentuate the type of body we wanted to see in that particular costume. Girls who could be a little more endowed on the top. Former cheerleaders say that while the teams dressed them like hookers, they were expected to comport themselves like virgins. To maintain the proper balance between sex and sparkle, to protect, in effect, the particular brand of fantasy they were creating, the Cowboys and other teams implemented a host of stringent rules. Most were pioneered by Suzanne Mitchell, a former PR executive whom Schramm put in charge of the DCC. Ostensibly meant to protect the cheerleaders, the original rules laid the groundwork for the kind of rigid policing that has sparked the present-day backlash among many millennial cheerleaders. No chewing gum, no wearing blue jeans, no appearing drunk in public, and absolutely no love handles. In a precursor to today's jiggle test, Mitchell set rigorous body standards before body shaming was even a concept. She instituted regular weigh-ins. You would stand there, and they would say, "Okay, I want you to turn around 1 inch at a time," Schultz recalls. "I am 5'5", I weigh 105, and they still wanted me thinner." Mitchell created lists of what she considered problem areas and circulated them to the entire squad. "I was always on a list that said thighs," recalls Dana Presley Kilmer, who joined the team in 1980. Other lists singled out those who needed to slim their midsections, those who needed to lose 5 pounds, and those who needed to drop 10, all within days, or else risk being benched. "There were a lot of girls who got into eating disorders," Schultz says. Or diet pills and cocaine. "Some lived on salads, yogurt, and beef bouillon cubes plopped in hot water, when they ate at all." To shed last-minute water weight, Kilmer encased her thighs in saran wrap, pulled on plastic dance pants, and rehearsed for hours. "We would go home and shower and be 4 pounds lighter," she says. Another of Mitchell's rigid rules had a lasting effect across the NFL, a ban on interactions between cheerleaders and players. Enforcement of the prohibition, however, was often skewed by gender. "A lot of the guys were cheating on their wives with the cheerleaders," Kepley says. "But if they were caught by the team, the cheerleader would usually take the fall." At the Honey Bears, Kaur recalls, "We had to let one of the girls go because she was in a pretty serious relationship with one of the guys. But when it came to the player, the team did nothing. 'Do you think I'm going to bench him?' Jim Finks, the Bears' general manager, scoffed at Kaur. 'He's not going to lose his job.'" Dallas also pioneered the practice of boosting its bottom line by having the cheerleaders make paid appearances at events like car shows and golf outings. But as millennial cheerleaders now allege, serving as the team's de facto ambassadors alongside fans, VIPs, and sponsors didn't always feel safe. Mitchell banned appearances where alcohol was served and sent along bodyguards, but cheerleaders still remember how uneasy they felt at such events. As the Schultz sisters recount in their memoir, one man flew a group of cheerleaders to Memphis to make an appearance at a huge indoor arena. But that night, when they arrived, there wasn't anyone there except 8 or 9 of his close buddies rolling around in this huge building that held about 10,000. The man was loaded and just wanted to have his own little private personal appearance. At one point, a fan began stalking Stephanie Schultz, waiting for her after games and calling her at night. "I can definitely relate to the Me Too movement," Schultz says. "I was horrified. I had to change apartments and telephone numbers." Sometimes cheerleaders made extra money for such appearances, as much as $500 for an event. But in a trend that continues to the present day, they were paid little to nothing for their work on game days. For the Honey Bears, it was as little as $10 per game. In San Diego, the girls were not paid a dime, says Rhonda Crossland, former director of the Chargettes. While the team racked up millions, the Chargettes held car washes and bake sales to pay for their uniforms and travel to away games. Lenita Schilling, who joined the Chargettes in 1977 at age 20, overlooked the lack of pay because she was an aspiring actress who hoped the squad would launch her career. "Now I see that the amount of time I put into it, the amount of dedication, the amount of volunteering for public appearances, it was just totally inappropriate and inequitable," she says. "Man, they were getting a sweet deal." Back then, however, there were no NFL cheerleaders filing lawsuits over pay. "I mean, what are you going to sue for? Back wages?" Schilling says. There were no wages. In fact, it didn't take long before NFL cheerleaders began to fight back against the low pay and inequitable rules. Kepley's breaking point came in 1978, when the Cowboys defeated the Broncos to win Super Bowl XII. After the game, the DCC were rushed off the field at the Louisiana Superdome and ushered onto a waiting plane, where they were forced to sit for hours without food or water. "I think it was because they didn't want us back in Dallas celebrating, going to nightclubs," Kepley says. "You still can't convince me to this day that they didn't keep us on that plane on purpose." To add insult to injury, Kepley and her fellow cheerleaders were not paid a cent for appearing at the Super Bowl. Their wages, it turned out, only applied to home games. "These guys get these $10,000 rings and these big bonuses, and they couldn't even give us our $14.12, Kepley says, referring to what the cheerleaders made for each home game after taxes. By that time, a lot of us said, "This is shit." That night, sitting on the runway in New Orleans, a group of disgruntled cheerleaders formed a rogue unit called Texas Cowgirls, Incorporated. Within weeks, they were suiting up in shiny blue unitards and marketing themselves for public appearances. They served as the opening act in actor Gabe Kaplan's Las Vegas show, and they recreated the official Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders poster for Playboy, minus their tops. The shoot featured Kepley opening a metallic jacket to flash one of her breasts. Cheerleaders from other teams also took part. Schilling, the Chargette, posed topless, seductively biting her lower lip. "The motivation was simple. I was getting paid," Schilling said, "and I wasn't getting paid for being a cheerleader." Schilling received more than $1,500, as much as she would earn in 10 seasons on the sidelines. The check helped pay for her wedding. The Playboy pictorial hit the league like a bombshell. The Chargettes not only fired Schilling, they disbanded the entire squad, even though the front office had known about the shoot in advance and encouraged the cheerleaders to participate. "I went straight through the front door," recalls Jeff Cohen, the photo editor at Playboy, who coordinated the pictorial. "I wasn't creeping around trying to find these girls." According to the article that accompanied the photo spread, San Diego was among the teams, including New England, Baltimore, Philadelphia, and Seattle, that extended Playboy every kind of courtesy. Next photo, frisky business. Marketing NFL cheerleaders as sex objects came at a steep price. Suzanne Mitchell, the Dallas squad director who instituted rigorous body standards that were widely imitated. The 1977 poster that sparked a craze. Cowboys general manager Tex Schramm, who led the move from sweaters to halter tops with NFL commissioner Pete Rozelle in 1979. Attorney Gloria Allred with former Houston cheerleaders pushing for higher pay outside NFL headquarters in June. The Cowboys, who had originally recast the cheerleaders as objects of sexual desire, lashed out when others tried to capitalize on their newly sexualized image. Dallas spent an estimated $1 million suing the distributor of the porn film Debbie Does Dallas over unauthorized use of what looked like a DCC uniform. The team also successfully sued Playboy photographer Arnie Freitag for making the poster featuring the topless Texas cowgirls. The lawsuits weren't about protecting the cheerleaders from unwanted exposure. They were about protecting the team's brand. As Freitag recalls, "I had to sit there and listen to the Cowboys' lawyer saying, 'Our cheerleaders are school teachers, and they're churchgoers, and how dare this guy sexualize our group of perfect, innocent young women?' And I'm like, 'Wait a minute. You can't put them in these little skimpy outfits and have no problems with TV cameras being up their skirts half the time on the football field and blame me for it. That's pretty hypocritical.'" Or, as Playboy observed in a statement defending the disbanded Chargettes, "The Chargers and other teams have wrapped these enthusiastic young ladies up like candy every weekend on national television. All we did is ask them to remove the wrapping." The cheerleaders themselves understood what was at stake. "It's an issue of ownership and power," says Schilling. "Anything that takes away from their power and control is threatening to them. When we were featured in Playboy, it was a bad reflection on management." The key difference between Dallas and Playboy was one of audience. The Cowboys, who operate in the heart of the Bible Belt, were careful to package the cheerleaders to appeal to male fans without drawing the ire of their wives or ministers. "The Cowboys weren't dummies," says Cohen, the Playboy editor. "Here they had big hair, big boobs, bouncy, smiley young women parading up and down the sidelines. They were well aware of what was necessary to get them the notoriety they were looking for, to drive ticket holders, drive eyeballs to TV, drive advertisers. They knew exactly what was going on. Sex might sell, but when it came to the cheerleaders, the message was clear. The only ones allowed to sell it were the NFL's owners." Ironically, as the years passed, the NFL shifted in Playboy's direction. Over the next three decades, the cheerleaders found their uniforms getting skimpier and skimpier. Hot pants made hotter, with V-shaped dips at the waist. Seductive posters gave way to swimsuit calendars and lingerie calendars. The pay, on the other hand, remained as low as ever, even as the league's profits soared. In 1995, one squad of cheerleaders decided to do something about it. The Buffalo Jills became the first and only squad to unionize, demanding better pay and equal treatment. "We were just tired of being used and abused," says Aaron McCormick Oliver, a co-captain who helped spearhead the unionization drive. "We were unique, intelligent, talented women, and we wanted to be respected for that." The Jills, who were paid nothing at the time but one ticket per home game and a parking pass, managed to negotiate a paycheck of $25 per home game or personal appearance. But the victory proved short-lived. The squad sponsor, Mighty Taco, dropped the Jills after they unionized. "Just being professional was a bridge too far for them," Oliver recalls. A local restaurant owner eventually agreed to step in on one condition: the Jills must drop their union affiliation. Without the protection of collective bargaining, the Jills once again found themselves at the mercy of the owners. "We were back at square one," says Oliver, who left the squad in 1999. In 2014, the Jills made news again when they became one of the first NFL squads to sue for back pay. The Oakland Raiderettes, who also sued, reached a settlement awarding them $1.25 million in back pay, or approximately $6,000 per cheerleader. But like the Chargettes before them, the Jills discovered that speaking up carried a heavy price. Rather than settle, Buffalo simply disbanded the squad. 4 years later, the case is still inching its way through the courts. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.